Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting a video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. This is going to be an interesting program. We're going to begin by looking at curcumin and how it improves the symptoms of obesity from Turan University of Medical Sciences. Also today, we have about 10 more studies, and again, we select our studies always with peer-reviewed literature in mind, respected institutions that are not covered for whatever reason by the mainstream media. We share it here because we want you to live a longer and healthier life. Then we're going to look at the Arctic, which we've been told will have disastrous consequences for the entire planet if it goes ice-free. Well, I've got a report here that I'm going to be sharing with you how it could go ice-free in the next 30 days. So now we're going to go back and remember what Professor Guy McPherson said about an Arctic free if it goes 2 degrees Celsius warmer in the Arctic. And the Arctic is one of the fastest warming areas of the planet. So things are speeding up at a level that we will not be able to change unless we become proactive and engage in a Marshall Plan, as we did, for those of you who may not know it or were too young. The Marshall Plan is what the United States did to help rebuild Germany, Italy, and Japan after World War II. We need that now in the environment. Also, today I'll be looking at, yes, sea algae. Interesting quote I found in today's Guardian, and it says, yes, algae is green and slimy, but it could be the future food. And I'll tell you why. A lot of you have already been having that. So we have a lot on the environment today. And also from Dr. Sherry Tenpenny will be a class on the air about vaccines. I've been trying to get to it, but other issues have taken the stage in front of it, but we'll get to it. But we begin always with health and healing. Now, consuming large amounts of curcumin, let's say 500 to 1,000 milligrams, that's the bioactive compound present in the spice turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C. If you've ever had Indian food, which is delicious and nutritious, you would have had dozens of varieties of turmeric. In fact, if you've ever gone to a market, even not in India, but if you went to a market in the United States that specialized in Indian food, you wouldn't see just one yellow turmeric. You'd see dozens of varieties. Now, they may not be that unique to our taste, but they sure are to the people in the country because they have a phenomenal amount of spices they use. That one happens to be extremely healing. And now we're told that it can improve non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and obesity in patients. So this is a major study. Taking curcumin supplements decrease factors that contribute to the two health conditions. People lost weight, and more importantly, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, meaning your liver is fat, that's bad. It's not going to function properly, that's worse. But it's not due to alcohol, which historically was the reason most people's liver was in bad shape. And almost 40% of the American population suffer from that. That's that high fructose corn syrup. That's what we're eating. So curcumin help eliminate that and also help improve the good cholesterol in the body, the HDLs. So you want healthier liver. You want to lose weight and have slimmer waistlines and fewer inflammatory biomarkers in the liver. Curcumin each day. From Johns Hopkins University comes a study about abnormal blood pressure in middle-aged and late-life influences and how it impacts dementia. In a study that spanned 25 years, they looked at data from more than 4,700 participants, and Johns Hopkins researchers have added to evidence that abnormal blood pressure, meaning too high blood pressure, especially from 35 to 50, is going to influence the development of dementia. And that's not good. So that's important. So what we want to get our blood pressure down. How do we do that? Well, lower the amount of sodium you're taking. Stress reduction is important because that'll cause blood pressure. Too much protein in the diet, and we're overeating protein, that'll cause high blood pressure. Okay? Simple things that we could do. Also, garlic helps. Vitamin C helps. Vitamin E. Magnesium really helps with blood pressure. And L-carnitine and coenzyme Q10. So, get your blood pressure down and save your life. Also, this is a study about stroke from the University of South Carolina, and it says that aerobic exercise programs can improve your endurance, and especially if you've had a stroke. We have millions of stroke survivors, and they have all seen that unless they really change their lifestyle and start thinning the blood, they can be susceptible to another stroke. That means you got to get the saturated fat from animal proteins and dairy out of the diet. So stroke survivors who completed group-based aerobic exercise programs, and it's similar to what they do in cardiac rehabilitation programs, significantly improved their aerobic endurance and walking ability. So this was sponsored by the American Heart Association and published in their Open Access Journal of the American Heart Association. So if you've had a stroke and you get on a healthy plant-based diet, and you exercise aerobically, you're going to improve your physical health tremendously, and there's no need to have a second stroke. Otherwise, a lot of people don't do aerobic exercise. They fear if they do aerobic exercise, they could precipitate another stroke. It's just the opposite. From a study at Korea University, barley sprouts, barley's a grain, barley sprouts can help address fatty liver disease. Now, we have two things to help fatty liver disease. And this is all about the cholesterol, which is a wax-like, fat-like molecule produced by the body and obtained from food. And its main functions are as a building material for cell membranes. And there's a lot of it in your brain. And as a component in the production of certain hormones and compounds that aid in fat digestion. However, high amounts of cholesterol in the blood lead to the development and exacerbation of chronic disease like coronary artery disease and hepatic stenosis, which is fatty liver. In cetosis, I should say, in a recent study published in the journal Nutrition Research, a Korean university investigated a compound called hexacosanol, H-E-X-A-C-O-S-A-N-O-L. That can help lower cholesterol levels. And this natural occurring agent can be found in barley sprouts. And that stops the accumulation of cholesterol via the straightforward mechanism. So eat your barley sprouts, lower your cholesterol. Also from the University of Cologne comes a study about pycnogenol. Pycnogenol is pine bark. P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L. And L-arginine, A-R-G-I-N-I-N-E. Now, arginine is known to have the ability in the body to create nitric oxide. That's a good thing. That improves your circulation to the brain, to the feet, but also to the reproductive system. But pycnogenol, used with L-arginine, can help address erectile dysfunction naturally. That's what this study showed. Now, when you consider the tens of millions of men who have problem with erectile dysfunction, this is a big plus because it's not the dangerous type of supplementation that you would have if you took one of the medications that has heart attacks as a side effect. And the body turns L-arginine into nitric oxide, and that serves as a neurotransmitter in the brain and spurs cardiac muscle tissue of the heart to work better and works as a vasodilator. And the vasodilating properties of nitric, N-I-T-R-I-C, nitric oxide, are of particular importance to patients with erectile dysfunction. And the chemical makes blood vessels open wider, thereby increasing the blood flow and allowing blood to reach the tissues that need them. The healthiest eaters are the most culturally fit. University of Wisconsin, what do I mean? According to University of Wisconsin, how to be a healthy eater depends on culture. A recent study shows that in the United States and Japan, people who fit better with their culture have healthier eating habits. The results appear in the Peer Review Journal Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. And it's about promoting particular types of healthy behavior as part of a culture. Now, I'll give you an example of this to make it even a little better to understand. If you go to, for example, the mountain area of Italy, where I've been several times, and you sit down to a meal, the culture dictates the meal be prepared slowly and with a lot of care. And they consider things like, as we age, our body has different needs. And they try to include what it needs, like they'll use a lot of herbs in the different foods. This is also true in Korea, South Korea, and in Japan, where they know that the healthiest medicine in the world is your food, and then your lifestyle, and your behavior, and your family. These are all included in the construct of living a healthier life. And they take their time eating. There's no rushing. There's lots of joy and laughter. It's where they bring issues together. They share that wonderful meal together. I've seen that also true in France and in Spain, Portugal. I have not seen that in England, Ireland, Scotland, and Germany. In fact, the most unhealthy food I've ever seen in Europe was in Germany. But be that as it may, if you went to Japan, the nightly bath. Now, it's not done so much today, except if you're older, but historically, you would sit in this little tub on a stool, the water would be coming up to your chest, there'd be a particular type of wood that would this cast in this little, you'd step into the little hot water, and then family members would then wash your hair and massage your back and head. You'd get head massage back. There'd be aromatherapy in there as well, and it was all part of the ritual. Then they would eat, and they would have to have things like seaweed and starchy vegetables, frequently tofu or fermented miso, and they would have fish. Occasionally they would have meat, but that was less so. And it turns out they had the longest lifespan in the world as a whole culture. Now that's changing because young people want to eat at McDonald's. They don't want to have, you know, that ritualized lifestyle. They don't want to take their shoes off when they enter the house. That's not all young people, but it's certainly a lot of them. And as a result, the lifestyle is changing within the younger population. That's true around the world. But that's what we mean about the best of a culture. Like in Greece, the Greek diet happens to be a very healthy diet, but not just what you eat, but how it's selected. The people going to great lengths to pick the purslane and the other greens. In Sweden, when I was in Sweden and when I was in Switzerland, you could take in the bitters baths, meaning you would go to a spa, and throughout the day you would have little glasses of these very bitter concoctions. And these would generally be grown right there. You could walk in and see them being grown, and they would squeeze them and press the juice out and give you different combinations based upon what you needed. Then you would take these baths, and then you would take a hot bath in one of these tubs or sauna. Then you go out into the snow, and they called it air breathing. Now, the Japanese do something similar. Again, these are cultural. But here's what we're seeing, and this is all over the world. Not everyone changes the culture of how they have grown up, but a lot of people have, especially a traditional culture trying to compete with slow food, slow conversation versus the speed at the internet and how you communicate and do everything quickly on the internet. So there's a clash, and it does impact people. And finally, from the University of Vermont, magnesium may work better than prescription drugs for treating symptoms of depression. So living with depression is challenging, but it's not about the quick fix in the form of antidepressants. I'm opposed to antidepressants. I've seen the side effects. And although there is some efficacy and only in small individuals groups within the depression, there are much better ways, more natural ways of dealing with depression. And one of those is magnesium. At the right level, magnesium can work wonders and can absolutely outproduce and result the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. One last thing, and this is from Ching Ching Hospital in Taiwan. Garlic was able to help people who had allergy-induced airway inflammation, turn off the inflammation in the lungs, and better for the person to breathe. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll, and we're going to take a break and come right back at you. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Coming down to work today, to the office here in the studio, a person came over to me, and I frequently get stopped on the streets of Manhattan. I've been here a long time, and people ask questions, and I'm happy to answer them if I know the answer. And a person said that they've been using the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for pain, and they said they have swollen fingers and wrists. They're always in pain. They're taking these. And they ask a question, would CBD oil work any better? They'd heard it would. Well, we're in a nation of pain. In fact, more than 25 million Americans every day, that's 11% of the population, complain of constant daily pain. But close to 40 million Americans, while they don't experience the pain every day, and it's not debilitating, do have to cope with severe pain. We spend $50 billion a year trying to deal with pain. And most of the people use some form of anti-pain medication or opiates, and the opiates lead to a crisis. Even a close friend of mine that I've known for 36 years told me that they went to the hospital and found that there was a big problem, and they had extreme pain in their fingers because of the diet. This person has a terrible diet. And so they said, but they gave me a medication and the pain went away. I said, what was the medication? OxyContin. I said, whoa, you are aware that that kills tens of thousands of people per year and is very addictive. No, I didn't know that. Well, you know, I gave them an insight. So the answer is yes. There are multiple benefits to using the oils, and it depends upon the quality of the oil, but the CBD oil is better than non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for eliminating pain and not getting you hooked on these medications which can kill you and do nothing to change the pain. At least CBD oil can help with the body biochemistry to turn off inflammation in a more natural way and help you respond. It's also good for people with lung conditions like COPD and even brain conditions, and that's important. And before we go further, I just want to mention that now the internet is censoring 5G criticism. That's correct. According to the Alliance for Natural Health, and they just sent me a note this morning, that big tech is nailing him. Now, anyone who heard my progressive commentary hour last night and watched it, it was an extremely powerful presentation by James Corbett of the Corbett Report, the most meticulous, detailed historical examination of who started the internet, who profits from the internet, who benefits from the internet, and who controls the internet. And it's nothing that we were told. So tomorrow, on our sister station, WBAI, I'm playing last night's program because a lot of people say we didn't, you know, we're not hip on the internet, so I play it on the local station. In any case, what has happened is over the last few months, as we report, is I've helped three separate demonstrations in New York in the last 2 weeks challenging 5G and writing two major articles on it, which are on PRN.fm, and broadcasting a program on it. Now, other people are using that information, plus coming up with the information other scientists and public health officials are saying 5G is dangerous. Do not allow it. Some communities, such as in Sacramento, have already seen the installation of what they call small cell towers near homes, near schools. And activists in Sacramento started to speak out. And they were on YouTube, and what they were saying was the truth. Here's the danger of 5G. They were immediately silenced. Noah Davidson, an activist in Sacramento, noticed his young nieces started experiencing health problems after Verizon installed a small cell just 45 feet from their home. Other members of the community also started experiencing adverse effects after small cells were installed. Davidson had worked to start a grassroots movement to raise awareness about 5G in the community and to work with telecom companies to establish an opt-out program for those who do not want it. Well, the companies are not allowing an opt-out. And because of Hillary and Bill Clinton, they now have the capacity to put a tower anywhere they want, irrespective of the health damages to humans, animals, or the environment. This is really fascism. But that's what we've been living with for 50 years. It's just been creeping totalitarianism. So what we have now is we have the internet censors not allowing information on anti-vaccines, on anti-GMOs, on challenging cancer establishment, on its failures. So anything that challenges the status quo is being censored by YouTube and Google. And so that's what you have to deal with. All the more reason to use some of the other sites that are not yet compromised. And I say not yet because we don't know what will be happening in the future to them as well. But just understand there are at least 26,000 scientists around the world who've read the literature, 10,000 peer-reviewed studies showing that 5G is dangerous. For example, 5G uses millimeter waves at a shorter wavelength than the current 4G networks in use. And millimeter wavelengths have been used in crowd control devices that shoot high-powered millimeter waves that make the target feel like their skin is burning. And other research has shown that our sweat ducts can act like antennas for the shorter millimeter waves, meaning we absorb more of this electromagnetic frequency when we sweat. So keep in mind that we will be exposed to electromagnetic frequencies generated by wireless devices on an unprecedented scale for two reasons. First, short millimeter waves cannot travel as far as longer waves, which is why many more small cell units must be installed to create a 5G network. In some neighborhoods, would see dozens of small cells installed, all of them emitting microwave radiation. And second, the sheer number of wireless devices will increase. More and more systems are becoming wireless or will become reliant on wireless technology. Now we have the advent of entire smart cities. Whole cities will use wireless networks to collect and analyze data about the environment and traffic and water and transit and lighting and waste management and security and parking. But they're all using these millimeter wave emitting devices that's going to saturate every square inch of where you live. Your body's going to be bombarded 24/7. And for those who are not informed, all of them have the capacity to take information from you and bring it back. For example, all those devices, tell me what the weather is today. And suddenly you hear a voice saying, the weather is. And play that old song, and your song is playing. Those devices are recording everything you say and do. Now, a lot of people have those devices in their living room, kitchen, and bedroom. They're inexpensive. Do you really want everything that you do in your bedroom to be a part of that? I don't think so. But people are uninformed. What I call intentional neglect leads to intentional ignorance, leads to dramatic unintended consequences. separately, and I will not have time today to go into it, we're going to start looking how whole concepts of speaking about something is now going to be considered hate crimes. For example, from Loblaw and Amos Goldberg and Raz Siegel, distorting the definition of anti-Semitism to shield Israel from all criticism, meaning that there's a growing tendency among both Jews and non-Jews to label those who have found that there are differences on, let's say, how to deal with the relationship between Palestinians and Israelis. If you question anything going on officially in Israel, you're now an anti-Semite. And to be called an anti-Semite is a severe construct. In most countries in the West, anti-Semitism is considered a taboo, and you don't want to be identified. So it's causing self-censorship. But I believe that an open society where we have funded Israel to such a tremendous degree that there should be an honest effort at a two-state solution where the Israelis feel confident and comfortable and safe in their environment as they deserve to be, but so too to completely tear down the walls and allow for the renewal of the Palestinian villages and no longer taking their territory. But you can't mention anything, no matter how ethical your intent is, and no matter how realistic your ability is to try to bring healing to that part of the world. You'd immediately be listed as an anti-Semite. That's how much power they have. In fact, just last week, 45 members, all Democrats, of Congress went on an all-expense-paid junket to Israel to sit with Netanyahu. Now, Netanyahu does not represent all the Jews in Israel. He represents the Zionist, and Zionism is not a religious philosophy. The founder of Zionism was an atheist. It's a political movement. There are a lot of very conscientious and good-natured and peace-loving and spiritually and morally ethical people, Jews, living in Israel. The ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox frequently are at loggerhead against the Likud party in the Knesset and Netanyahu. So you can have legitimate concern about the outcome of the way that Israel is dealing with the Palestinians or the Palestinians are dealing with Israel without being an anti-Semite. And if we're not careful, in the very near future, by law, you will not be able to say anything about Israel or you'll be called an anti-Semite and then your reputation destroyed. That's where the propaganda machine behind the scenes has been going on by the AIPAC and the other groups supporting the Israeli hard right wingers. And if you think President Trump is, you know, far right, Netanyahu's about 6 degrees beyond that. So there's not going to be any good outcome. There's only going to be conflict and more pain and suffering of the Palestinians till there's an open, honest dialogue where you bring people in who are neither anti-Jewish or anti-Palestinian and look for a peaceful solution. And we just haven't been looking for peaceful solutions, and we should. So that's something just to be thinking about, and I'm going to be doing more on that in upcoming programs, including bringing philosopher and ethicists on to talk about what are the most realistic ways that we could have people live together in an environment that for the last 60 years has been a powder keg, and no one benefits in the... Well, I won't say nobody benefits. Clearly, when you have conflict, someone benefits, and those who control the dialogue. We're going to take a brief break.
Here I am, baby. Oh, I'm
I'd like to welcome you all. Let's go over and hear a little bit, just the beginning of Sherry Tenpenny talking about vaccines.
Welcome for everybody. Boy, this is a great group. What a great day to be doing something like this. I mean, it's raining, right? So you can't be out in your garden. You can't be doing anything else like that. So how many of you guys have come to one of these events before? All right, good. So you know that it's a lot of fun and we're going to be doing a lot of good things. How many have ever heard me speak before? None of you? Wow. Oh, a couple down in the front. Okay. So I just need to make sure. Yeah, there we go. So if that's the case, then let me tell you a little bit about who I am and what I do. So my name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. I am probably known as the international expert on vaccine injuries and problems associated with vaccines. I've been involved with this for 17 years and about 30,000 hours of my life in terms of research and speaking and traveling around the world giving talks like this. My first career was as a board-certified emergency physician. I was the director of an ER for 12 years. Then I moved to Cleveland, Ohio in 1996, and I opened an integrative medicine practice for which I'm always proud to say we've had people from all 50 states and about 17 foreign countries to come to our clinic to get well and get off their pharmaceutical drugs. So I got involved with this serendipitously, like a lot of things do. I got a notification in the mail in September of 2000 from the National Vaccine Information Center meeting in Washington, D.C. And it was supposed to be in September of that year, and it was really inconvenient for me to go. And I actually went so far as to call them and say, when is your next meeting? Because I don't think I can come this time. And they said, well, we're a small nonprofit. We're not sure we're going to have another one. We said, okay, so every time I went to throw that brochure away off my kitchen counter, it just kind of made its way back onto the kitchen counter. So I was single at the time, and I thought, oh, I know. This is it, Lord. This is where I'm supposed to be to meet the guy. So I went down to the, so I made a reservation. I went down to the meeting, and it wasn't about the guy. It was about the topic. And I sat through 4 days of nonstop lectures, which I think it was the only conference I've ever been to in my entire life that I sat through all of the lectures and took copious notes and heard researchers and PhDs and doctors and parents talk about vaccines and vaccine injuries. There was about 700 people in that conference, a lot of people that were there with their vaccine-injured children in wheelchairs. And all I could think of is, while I was there, was how did I miss this as part of my education as a physician? You know, I've been in medicine at that time for 15 years. I was the director of an ER. I gave out tetanus shots like they were some special kind of candy. I've had my integrative medicine practice now for almost 5 years. And I grew up in a chiropractic family, 3 generations of chiropractors. I wasn't vaccinated as a kid. None of my cousins or any of their kids were vaccinated, so it was never on my radar because I had age-appropriate measles, mumps, rubella, chicken pox, and I had pertussis twice. And I'm 59 and here to talk about it. Nobody died. And so we get so terrorized into these infections that we need to change the language about that because we call them diseases. And everybody gets all weirded out and scared like somebody's going to die over these normal childhood infections that were supposed to come at age-appropriate levels, somewhere mostly between the ages of 6 and 9, that left you with a lifetime of immunity, not only so that you could be healthy as you went into your 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, but that you could pass that health on to your children. So that's how I got involved with this. And after that meeting, I went home and I started saying, well, where do you start? Where do I start looking at this? I know, I'll start with the CDC. So I started going to the CDC documents and read the general recommendations of vaccination, the 1998 version of that, which was such a poorly written paper and such poor documentation. It was a 42-page paper. I still have it, by the way. And I thought, this can't be what this entire industry is built on. This really can't be it. So from there, I started reading all of the mainstream medical literature, the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, Vaccine, JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, and it's all in there. The problems associated with vaccines are in the mainstream medical journals. Physicians just choose to flip right by it because it isn't anything they're interested in reading. So that's how I kind of came to this. And each thing that I read, it became almost like an addiction because I kept thinking, "This, I must be missing something. What am I missing? Where is this? Why can't I find why this is so important?" And the deeper down the rabbit hole I went and the more information that I found, the more shocking it was to me. And I went back to Kathy Williams, who's one of the co-founders of the National Vaccine Information Center, and said, "Surely, if people just knew how vile that stuff was that's coming through the vial, they would like stop and run the opposite direction so fast it looked like the Roadrunner, like beep, beep, psh, be gone. We would implode this industry in like a nanosecond once people understood that there were cells from aborted fetal tissue and aluminum and mercury and formaldehyde and stray viruses that can cause cancer in these things they're given to their children. Surely as soon as they know that, it will stop." Well, you know, 17 years later, we have more vaccines than ever. We have mandates breathing down our neck. We want everybody in the government to take away our rights. So that's why I do this. And that's why, you know, when Patrick heard me talk and I spoke at his meeting last year, he said he wanted me to come up and give this information to all of you on this lecture on Vaccines 101. Because we want to try to boil it down into bite-sized pieces, which, by the way, they're going to be passing around a clipboard for you guys. If you want to be part of my email list and the information we sent out, please just put your name and your email list in a way that, or your email, in a way that I can actually read it, because it doesn't do any good to write it down if I put an R and it's supposed to be an S into my database. So, because we're pretty active. My Facebook page has 217,000 people. We just started a course called Mastering Vaccine Info, foundational course in online training that we have we've got almost 100 people enrolled in that. It will reopen for enrollment in March. If you want to be on the waiting list for that, let me know. Because it goes through everything. It goes through everything in a way that's bite-sized pieces, about 20 minutes of content, and then the Thursday night Facebook Live discussion group to teach you how to take the language in those modules to become a confident parent, an intelligent leader in your home and your community, and an articulate activist. And that's what we're trying to train everybody to do. So let's get started with this. There are some basic assumptions behind the entire industry of vaccination. In fact, when I got started with this in September of 2000, if you think about the pharmaceutical industry is like a big pie diagram, and a piece of the pie is like cancer drugs, hypertension drugs, you know, all these different drugs that they do, which is all their book of business, their lines of things that they market and sell. At that point in time, the little teeny tiny pie diagram of the vaccine industry was about a $5 billion a year industry. Now they're approaching $54 billion. And why is that so important to know? It's because vaccines, if you vaccinate 100 people, at least 50% of them are going to have a serious side effect. Then you get taken to all of these doctors and all of these tests to find out that, was it the vaccine? Probably not. It was because you had this underlying pathology that was just going to automatically pop up just exactly when you got the vaccine. And then they've got this entire $1 trillion book of business to sell you all these drugs to manage the side effects that you just got from the vaccines. So the vaccines are actually the economical pharmaceutical industry's loss leader. How many of you guys in here have businesses? Or your husband does, or you know, whatever, you have businesses. So you know what a loss leader is, right? A loss leader is like, I'm going to give away a t-shirt for free. It says on the door, on the sign on your door, free t-shirt, come inside. So you get people to come in for the free t-shirt, so while they're in your door, you can sell them the $1,000 Armani suit. Well, the vaccines are the economic loss leader. Do it for free, mandate it, get your flu shot at every Walgreens, Walmart, every grocery store. I got a thing the other day, they took a picture of it. It said, if you get your flu shot today at Giant Eagle, we'll give you 10% off your groceries. So everywhere, they're pounding people with these vaccines. It's their economic loss leader. Doesn't cost them anything, cost them pennies. And then they've got a $1 trillion book of business to sell you once you start having side effects. asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, ear infections in kids, insulin-dependent diabetes, autoimmune diseases. They have an entire book now, textbook, on vaccines and autoimmune diseases. All of those things start happening, so now we can drive, it's the driver of the entire industry. And these are some of the assumptions: that vaccines are safe. We're going to go through that in a little more detail. That vaccines are effective, meaning they protect you and keep you from getting sick. That we as physicians and you as a consumer, when you hear the word effective, automatically goes into your head. You think, oh, that keeps me from getting sick. That's not what effective means in the vaccine industry. Vaccines have very few side effects, except for the fact that the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that went into effect in 1986 and the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System has year-to-date been paid out over $3.2 billion in vaccine injury claims through the government program, and they estimate that's less than 10% of people who've actually been injured. $3.2 billion in vaccine injuries. And every time you read any sort of a paper, or you hear anybody on the pro-vaccine advocate side, or you hear anybody in the government talk about vaccines, this is what they always say, that they're the most significant public health advances of the 21st century. After all, we saved the world from smallpox and polio, didn't we? We go into that in great detail in my course, because actually we didn't. And we've spent billions of dollars for nothing on this polio eradication. But that's another talk for another day. So what about, are vaccines safe? And what is the meaning of a safe vaccine? Well, it's not really what you think. That the Webster's Dictionary of Safe says, giving protection, which is what we think it should be, you know, if you have a security system in your house, it keeps you safe, involving no risk. No risk. Every package insert on every vaccine talks about the risk of vaccination. They are trustworthy and unable to cause trouble or damage. Well, we've already said the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has paid out $3.2 billion, and all of these vaccine injuries that compound one upon each other creates the business driver for the pharmaceutical industry, so we know that they cause damage. So by definition, they break the definition of what safe is supposed to be. So the real problem then comes with vaccine safety studies. How do they come to the conclusion that they can put in a package insert which is specifically designed for information for your doctor that your doctor is supposed to know? How do they design these studies and come to the conclusion that they are safe? Well, there's four specific problems. And problem number one is that safety studies do not use a true placebo group. And if you take anything away from this talk today, I want you to remember this. Because in conventional medicine, the double-blind, placebo-controlled study is the gold standard for safety. If they're bringing to market, say, a new medication for, say, hypertension, they would give you guys over here the real drug, and you guys over here the sugar pill. And they would want to see, of the real drug compared to the sugar pill, what were the levels of side effects? What kind of reactions did people have? Did it really bring down your blood pressure as compared to this group over here that just got the sugar pill? And when they double-blind it, what that actually means is that the person that you come in to see to participate in the study, when I give you a pill or I give you a pill, I don't know whether I'm giving you the real drug or if I'm giving you the sugar pill. I'm just giving you a pill and then keeping track of your symptoms. So that's a double-blind study. I don't know which of you are getting what. And placebo means it's compared to something that's totally inert. In vaccine studies, they never use a true placebo. And that started all the way back with the polio trials back in 1954 when they did this mass vaccination of the Salk injectable polio vaccine, and they said it was really unethical to give these people a vaccine and to give you nothing if we have to give a shot. So one of the arms of the trial actually gave the placebo as a tetanus shot. So it started way back when that if you're going to get a shot, you ought to have something of value. And so then we get the side effects of the polio vaccine compared to the side effects of the tetanus shot. How can we, and if this has the same amount of side effects as this, then we say it has the same amount of side effects and reactions as the placebo, which was another vaccine. That's not a placebo. And now in the package inserts, what they don't even call it, even try to get away with calling it a placebo anymore. What they call this tetanus shot, this other one that they give you, they call it a comparator. We're going to compare the side effects of the new vaccine compared to the side effects of a vaccine that we already know what those side effects are supposed to be. And if the new vaccine has the same amount of side effects as one that we know is supposed to be there, then we say this new one is safe. There's no true placebo ever. And when I go to talk to doctors and nurses that are in the hospital and they don't have any of this information, when I drop that little factoid of saying that there is no true placebo used when they define safety in a safety trial, I would see it's kind of like a cartoon. It's like their head goes like an eggshell. Like, what do you mean? That's the gold standard for all investigational medicine. Not in the vaccine world, it's not. What they use instead, because they consider it unethical to give a vaccine to one group and hold from another group, therefore the placebo should have some benefit. It should be a vaccine. So can you see already where the whole idea that vaccines are safe starts to fall apart from the implementation of the safety studies? They've never really had a safety study. Problem number two is that studies don't use inert substances as a placebo, like a sugar pill is inert. Well, if we're going to compare one vaccine to another vaccine, is this vaccine over here inert? No, because it has its own side effect profile. So the placebo used is often another vaccine, like I said, with a known safety profile. If the experimental vaccine has the same number and types of effects as the placebo vaccine, then the experimental vaccine is said to be safe as placebo. And you see that in all the package inserts. You see that in the published medical literature, in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, or in JAMA, or in the England Journal, they'll say it was safe as placebo. Then you dig through the study to try to find out what the placebo was. Sometimes they list it, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you have to go to the FDA and look at the original trials to find out what the placebo was. But most of the time, it was another vaccine. Another example is that in the Gardasil trials, that they actually used an injection of aluminum as the placebo. Gardasil has, has the highest amount of aluminum of any vaccine, but there's new vaccines that have come out that have larger amounts of aluminum. The Gardasil 4 that came out in 2006 had 250 micrograms of aluminum. Now Gardasil 9 that came out a couple of years ago and has become the one that they give everyone around the world has 500 micrograms of aluminum. And we're going to see in a few minutes that the new meningitis B vaccine has 1,500 micrograms of aluminum, which is a big deal. So this is where in Gardasil, you know what Gardasil is? Gardasil is the vaccine that they want to give all the girls to say one less girl. Yeah, when they say one less girl, what goes in my mind is one less girl able to have children in the future is what the rest of that sentence should be. Because Gardasil has been shown to cause testicular atrophy in male mice and stop periods and atrophy of the uterus in female mice. So Gardasil is this vaccine that was only tested on 12,000 girls before they started administering it to 9 to 12-year-old girls of age back in 2006. Most vaccine clinical trials on an international basis have tens of thousands of people. This one was only tested on 12,000. They were followed for only 6 months, when in vaccine trials, they usually follow things for about 4 years, and in medication trials, they follow them for longer than that. The observation for adverse events was 15 days. How long does it take for an autoimmune reaction to form? Months. They only followed this because all they were looking for was acute allergic reactions, swollen arm, sick to their stomach, headache. They only followed it for 15 days. The average age for developing cervical cancer is somewhere between 38 and 42. And the placebo that was used was a shot of aluminum, and Gardasil has aluminum in it. So each Gardasil dose has 225 micrograms of aluminum, and when about 25% experienced the injection and pain after the Gardasil, and about 16% had pain after the shot of aluminum, the conclusion was Gardasil was declared to be as safe as the placebo. Which is pretty common. I mean, this is just one example that I could give you of the 56 vaccines that are currently approved in the US market, and there are almost 310 in the developmental pipeline. Now, some of the vaccines in the developmental pipeline are specific indicators. A lot of them are in the cancer segment because what they're trying to do is come up with DNA vaccines to manipulate your DNA and genetics. Nothing could go wrong with that, right? Nothing could possibly go wrong with a DNA vaccine to change your genetics permanently and then pass that on to your children. But all of the vaccines, and then they are coming up with specific indicator vaccines, like there's a vaccine under development for cocaine addiction, one for hypertension, one for periodontal disease. So they're trying to eliminate dentists? I mean, I don't know. But these are the sorts of things that are in development down the way. And so this was the vaccine that came to market that currently there are 7 countries around the world that are about to ban the use of Gardasil and the international equivalent, which is called Cervarix, because of all the deaths and chronic long-term disability that's being caused by this vaccine. So if you've got kids that are coming up, teenagers, please get educated about this vaccine. And if there were any of them that you were going to refuse, I mean, in my opinion, that you should refuse all of them. But if you were going to refuse any, absolutely do not allow your kids to get this vaccine. Because they're giving it to boys now, too. They started that about 5 years ago, primarily because they wanted to double their market share. They felt like they were missing out on half the population. And because we know that those dirty little 9-year-old boys are going to be having sex with those promiscuous 9-year-old girls, and they're going to be sharing their HPV viruses back and forth. Because that's the age group that you have to give this, because if you give it after you've had intercourse, it doesn't work. 100% of the female population, well, let me say that again. They estimate somewhere between around 98% of the entire female population has an HPV infection sometime in their life. I mean, the cervix is an external organ, right? It's like your nose. It's an external organ. And about 98% of people actually have that infection sometime in their life. And somewhere close to 97.5% of people who have the infection clear it in 2 years or less. So we're actually giving a vaccine because less than 2% of all humanity gets this vaccine and it doesn't, or gets the virus, and it doesn't go away within 2 years. And maybe, maybe not causes cancer, but we're going to vaccinate the entire global population and destroy the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of teenagers for really something that can be prevented with a pap smear. I know, this is supposed to be like a celebration, right? Isn't this kind of like heavy? Remember Patrick Vitavi here, right? So we got to keep this a little bit light. So here's the slide I was telling you. This is all the different concentrations of aluminum now. And we know that aluminum causes Alzheimer's. We're pretty sure that aluminum contributes to other types of neurological conditions. Aluminum, is once it's injected, it stays in the muscle for an extended period of time, and it's really not cleared from the body. So poison for poison, in the last decade, many studies in animal models have repeatedly demonstrated that aluminum can inflict immune-mediated diseases, autoimmune, neurological, and skin disorders. But yet we've got all of those vaccines that have aluminum in them, including the hepatitis B vaccine that's given at birth. So if you get a vitamin K shot and a hepatitis B vaccine at birth, you get 330 micrograms of aluminum injected into your baby before they're 2 days old. And so then if they have problems down the road, how do you know? Because now the doctors will say, well, they were just born that way. Were they? Or was it all that gunk that you injected into them as soon as they landed on the planet? So, now what about, so a few more problems with social study, or with safety studies. So far we've said what? There's no placebo. They don't use an inert substance. Problem number 3, vaccine trials usually include 3 injections to create an antibody response. So they give the first one, they say that primes the pump. The second one locks in immunity.
I'm Gary Noll. This is one place we're not going to blink. Have a nice day, everyone.